Okay, so what we've seen so far we've seen two ways in which we would like to we need to describe let's say transformations via a CPTP map, where CPTP means completely positive and trace preserving. Okay, that was by mixtures of unitaries, and the other approach is when we have a unitary on a system coupled to an ancilla, and we trace out the ancilla, the effective transformation on the system is a completely positive map. It's not a unitary transformation, for example. And then we had a big digression about representations of superoperators, which, I mean, since you haven't really worked with superoperators much, maybe it was hard for you to see the value of that, but I think eventually when you start doing computations with these things, you'll see how that helps clarify the structure of what you're doing. So having seen, just like in the previous cases, we've seen situations that give rise to these maps, but now the question is, is any such mathematical map a physical transformation? And the answer is yes. The constant of that is the Steinspring dilation theorem. So recall our discussion on Friday. Unitaries act on states, on vectors in our base Hilbert space. Superoperators like lambda act on linear operators, so they act on density operators. So maybe I should mention here that we have, for example, our transformation box, we have row in and row out. Then we would say row out equals lambda row in. Where if we wanted to, we could put two hats on the lambda to remind ourselves that it's a super operator. And let me just say as another aside, if the transformation is unitary, on the Hilbert space on H, then lambda rho is equal to U rho U dagger. So in this picture, we say that U, our unitary U, which is familiar from, you know, third grade, U acts on the state vector. But as a super operator, U acts, we say, via conjugation on the density operator. So conjugation just means you multiply from the left with U and from the right with U dagger. It's just like the Heisenberg picture, which you've all seen. But now we're acting on density operators. So the dagger's on the right. So any CPTP map, can be realized as a unitary acting on HA tensor HB. In particular, we have lambda rho. If lambda is CPTP, it can always be realized as the trace over B of U rho tensor sigma U dagger for some sigma, which is a state operator on HB. So I should say sigma here would be a density operator. All right, so that completes our description of the generalized postulates. So in each case, we've seen that going from pure state vectors to density operators, we saw two ways to do that, and we saw that the most general structure we identified, i.e. density operators, every density operator mathematically corresponded to some physical realization in terms of pure states on a bigger Hilbert space. Actually, I didn't prove that to you, I just told that to you. And then similarly for POVM measurements and similarly for CPTP maps. So now we have this very general structure in that if you can write down a mathematical map of this form, I can go find some method to realize it in the lab. In principle, given enough control. Okay, so now I think that, yeah?
Is it true that if you had a one-parameter family of CPTP maps, that those could come from a one-parameter family of unitaries acting on the composite system? In other words, is Steinspring sort of continuous?
Is it true that if, could you restate the beginning of that sentence?
So does that mean that if you want to describe dynamics as a continuous family of CPTP maps, that any one of those would come from a continuous family of unitaries acting on the composite system?
Okay, that's a great question. And I probably know the answer to that, but I'd have to think it through a bit carefully. So let me just tell you some background information and we'll kind of converge to an answer. So it's in general a hard problem to, okay, actually, you know what? You're anticipating some things I'm going to talk about, so rather than do this out of order, let me come back to that. Okay, so decoherence. So now we can discuss some features of quantum mechanics now that we have this generalized formalism. In particular, I think that it's important that you guys see a little bit of motivation. You've gone through all this detailed effort trying to understand all the nuances of the postulates. So let's kind of understand how they come in simple examples you know. Okay, so consider the hydrogen atom. Okay, we have some Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian H, which encodes the relevant forces. So what do we have? We have the Coulomb interaction between the electron and the proton. We write everything out in terms of Cartesian coordinates. Then we want to switch to spherical coordinates, and the problem divides into a center of mass frame with the relative position and the total position and relative momentum, and we divide the problem into, you know, there's one is the electron proton structure becomes a one individual effective mass, which is at rest in some reference frame, and then we're just in the relative motion between them. That brings in an orbital angular momentum term, which gives us a spin orbit coupling. So we have the Coulomb force between them, we get the effective spin orbit coupling. Then if we want to be fancy, we can include the hyperfine splitting, which is the coupling between the electron spin and the nuclear spin. And then there's a few other factors. There's a relativistic correction you usually see in undergrad quantum mechanics, and what's the other thing you typically include? Sorry? Anyone remember? There's one thing I'm forgetting. I'm sorry?
The Darwin term. Yeah,
what's
the correction for only the lowest energy level? Because there was a non-zero probability of the electron entering inside the proton or something.
Huh. Does that have to be put in by hand?
Yeah.
There's two things Yeah, okay. I thought there was just two things, but maybe there's more details that I'm forgetting. But okay, but so thank you. And so you get a picture of you include all these forces, and those all go into the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian has all of these operator terms in it, which define the problem based on how careful you're being. And then, you know, you can look this up in any standard undergrad textbook, so I'm not going to go through it. But what you get then is you get some eigenequations. Which define eigenstates of the hydrogen atom and eigenenergies of the hydrogen atom. And what's the Hilbert space that we're actually working in? Okay, so the Hilbert space, go on. It would be L squared of R3. And then we're also have to add the spin. That's another degree of freedom at play. And this is assuming we've dropped out the proton has 3 degrees of freedom and the electron has 3 degrees of freedom, right? So it's really R6. But here we're just dealing with the center, what's it called, the relative motion, which is normally what you treat for the relative. Is that the right term? Is it relative motion, or is there some other? The center of mass frame and the relative motion? Okay, so just to fit that in the context of what we've been looking at with Hilbert spaces, so you do this, and this is kind of in the background. You don't really know, it doesn't come up explicitly. Okay, great, so that's my system. Now what do? We apply our postulates. So we prepare the atom in some way. Okay, so now we prepare the atom. We prepare the atom, and I know my atomic physics, and I have a very good laser, so I'm going to shine a laser on the atom. First, I'm going to trap the atom. Okay, so we stick it in an ion trap. So it's essentially almost at zero temperature. And then what we do is we wait much longer than the lifetime of the excited states that were accessible through emotional vibration. I should say accessible okay, why am I doing that? What happens if I do all this? Then what can I say about the state of the atom? It goes into a ground state, right, exactly. So now with high confidence, I can say that the initial state rho at time t equals 0, which is when I start counting. So that it, after this time has elapsed, now I turn on my stopwatch, and I'm going to put it in the ground state. Atom is in ground state. Okay, now what do I do next? What I do next is I have a laser and I know the exact energy gap from the ground state to the first excited state, first accessible one under the selection rules by absorbing a photon. So I'm going to shine a laser of frequency omega equal to E1 minus E0 over H bar for a time tau, carefully chosen time tau, so that I'm going to raise the electron into the first excited state. So that we say the electron, really it's the electron-proton system. So the atom goes from, let me change boards. Is this one still broken? Because this manually, does this manually go up?
Down goes up.
All right, I give up. Okay. Memorize that, right? Okay, good. Okay, so what am I doing here? So what I'm doing is I'm shining so Adam gets. Undergoes. U tau at frequency omega acting on rho zero, U tau at frequency omega. I guess my tau should be an argument in here. Actually, it's really just tau times omega that matters. Rho tau, where rho tau is equal to phi one. Now, none of this is going to be perfect. I'm not going to actually be in the ground state when I start. I'm just going to be in the ground state with high probability. When I apply this laser pulse, I'm not going to exactly be in the first excited state. I'll just be in it with some probability. There might be some residual coherence with other levels. There might be some mixing with other levels. So now here's my pop quiz for you guys. And now, if you know the answer, don't shout it out. Just raise your hand. Okay, so now if we have unitaries describing the evolution of this system, so for any unitary, we would write where H is our Hamiltonian. But for this U, so this is U atom acting on phi n u dagger atom is equal to phi n. So under the evolution of the Hamiltonian, system stays in whatever eigenstate I put it in. How do I get atomic decay? Okay, thank you, but just hold on a second, I want to see, I want you guys all to think about it. How do I get atomic decay now? What am I missing? So this is a bit tricky until you look at it the right way. Do you want to venture an answer? I'll repeat it. The answer is right. So he's saying that what we're missing in this description is we're missing an interaction term between the Hilbert space of our system and the vacuum. So atomic decay is associated with the creation of a photon. So now that becomes a new degree of freedom in our description. And in physically what's going on is that we have, when you quantize the electromagnetic field, you get a coupling between the atom and the vacuum, or if you put the atom in a cavity with the cavity modes. And that interaction Hamiltonian does not commute with this Hamiltonian. So the question was, how do we get atomic decay? And the answer is we don't, unless we include, we need to include the ancilla consisting of the electromagnetic field. For example, the vacuum state. And then that Hilbert space via this interaction Hamiltonian . So notice that this answer was disguised also in the preparation. You allowed me to say for my preparation that I was shining a laser on the atom and exciting it. But I didn't give you a Hamiltonian for that. So there's some other interaction Hamiltonian which describes the coupling to the, say, a monochromatic laser to the atom, which is similar to the interaction Hamiltonian that's going to couple the atom to the vacuum field. And that's what allows us to change the energy eigenstates of the atom to prepare the system. And this interaction Hamiltonian here is what allows the atom to decay. In general, a complete mathematical description of that is very involved and usually involves approximations. Okay? So an exact treatment is difficult. But we have very good phenomenological models for this. Which I'll tell you more about in a minute, but let me just mention the term. So Lindblad operators and amplitude damping channels. which can capture the physics of it with some free parameters that we fit from experiment or approximate from a first principles derivation. So what I want to do is, yeah?
Sorry, I'm wondering, what you have in the parentheses at the end of your last statement?
Oh, in the parentheses, I'm sorry. We have, I said very, that's supposed to be very good. Very good phenomenological models for this. And the phenomenological, some examples of these phenomenological models are the Lindblad operators, which gives us a continuous time description of relaxation and decoherence, and amplitude damping channels, which give us a finite time description of relaxation and decoherence. So the point of this was to kind of get you thinking about how we're using these postulates to describe the physical processes we want to describe, and also to motivate, I wanted to give you some examples of completely positive maps. And I think this shows you the kind of context where it's useful. Of course, the contexts are extremely broad. This is just one example. I could have given you like 100 of these. And so let's look at some simple toy models to understand the phenomenology of decoherence. Phenomenology. I don't know why I'm pulling out such a fancy word for this occasion. Phenomenology of decoherence. Okay, so just to make sure you're getting the sense of what's going on. Okay, so we'll consider two systems, HA and HB. And we can start out in initial state, T equals zero. We'll just call this the zero state of A, tensor the zero state of B. So now we have a product system state. So you can think of this as the atom is in some fixed state, and the electromagnetic field is on some fixed state. Even I slip into the language problems, is described by some fixed state, okay? And then we're gonna have, in general, there is some interaction Hamiltonian, which is a linear operator on both Hilbert spaces. For example, H int might be of the form C sigma x tensor sigma x. We have two spin half particles. That's a coupling term in the Hamiltonian. And then generically, then we have U interaction, for some time t, or tau, I guess I'm calling it. And then what's going to happen is we're going to have a state psi at time tau, which is equal to u int acting on 0, tensor 0. And that's going to give us, that's going to be, we can just describe this in general as some, say, sum over L alpha L of tau L tensor L. Okay, so I'm doing this in a very abstract setting just to capture the full generality of this. And you can think of these systems however you want. I mean, this is a very general picture for coupling two spins or coupling the atom to the electromagnetic field. It just depends on how we assign these Hilbert spaces and what physics we put into this coupling interaction. And then we evolve the system for some time tau, and we get this entangled state, And we'll learn more about entanglement in a bit. But the point is, this is now a product, this is not a product state. Now the key point is, if we do not have access to HB, okay, so HB might be a lot of different things. So suppose I'm trying, at the beginning of my setup, I was trying to trap my atom inside my ion trap and let it cool down so I had essentially a ground state of vibrational modes. So you can think of it as, think of the ion trap as you have basically a particle in a harmonic oscillator and you let it cool down to its ground state, where that harmonic oscillator is associated with the physical motion of the particle in the trap. Now, what's HB? HB can be a lot of things. It could be a dust particle that comes in and interacts electromagnetically with my ion in the trap. It could be a stray gamma ray photon that came from, you know, some supernova that happened 7 billion years ago, passes through my experiment. It could be a slight interaction between the vibrational modes because my system isn't fully cooled. So my atom isn't really in the ground state. It's in some vibrational excited state. And because I'm ignoring the motional degree of freedom, I have an entanglement between the internal states of the atom and the motional degree of freedom. Right, so anyway, so okay, well, that's a pretty long list of examples. And in a lot of those cases, we don't have access to HB. So it can't be part of my formal description. I mean, it can be part of my formal description, but it can't be part of my practical description. If it's a gamma ray photon that bounced off my ion, that's already like halfway to the moon by the time I, you know, do the next step in my experiment, right? So now we want to describe only system A. All right, so how do we do that? Partial trace, right. This is obvious to you guys. So now I have rho A at time tau is the partial trace over B of, let me call it rho of tau. And rho of tau is going to be a little bit of a messy thing to write out, but it's going to be psi tau, which I'm going to sum over L and K, and I'm going to have alpha L and alpha K bar L tensor L K tensor K. Okay, so this is my state. I've written it out explicitly. And then I'm going to take the partial trace. Is this something I'm going to be able to do on the board here? Let's see. Under the partial trace, in general, rho A will not be pure. Okay, it'll be some mixed state. So how do we characterize that? Well, the easiest way to characterize that is to look at the trace of the square of rho A. So trace of rho A squared will be less than 1. But remember, if this is equal to 1, that means it's pure. But now, because of tracing out the Ancilla system, we're going to be left with a mixed state. Okay, I won't give an explicit description of this, but just state that in general this is the case. I mean, there'll be certain choices of parameters where this actually decouples, but we're not going to worry about that. And so this is decoherence. So here's the point. This loss of purity and hence coherence of system A due to interaction with some ancilla is called decoherence. So how can we come up with a nice, what are these phenomenological models for this process? A good model for this process in particular, the atom, in particular, the spontaneous decay of the atom, is called an amplitude damping channel. Okay, so amplitude, this is a CPTP map. Of the following form. Lambda acting on rho in gives rho out, and lambda is equal to a sum over k equals 0 and 1, 0 to 1, ak rho in ak dagger, where the aks are the Krauss operators, and in particular, we have A0 is equal to, here let for HA equal to a two-dimensional Hilbert space, so a spin half, we have A0 is equal to 1, 0, 0, 1 minus gamma, and A1 is equal to 0, square root of gamma, 0, 0. And what this will do is, if you put a pure input state, say the 0 state in here, so this is written in the 0, 1 basis. If you put in the 0 state and evolve under this completely positive trace-preserving map, the output state will lose purity and will become a mixed state. So in particular, I have to erase. In particular, we have rho out is equal to A0 in
A0 rho in plus A1 rho in A1 dagger.
And then, so let's just explicitly parameterize rho in as rho 0, 0, rho 0, 1, rho 1, 0, rho 1, 1. Then if we just go through the simple matrix multiplication required to evaluate this, we are left with rho out equal to rho 0, 0 plus gamma rho 1, 1, 1 minus gamma rho 0, 1, 1 minus gamma rho 1, 0, 1 minus gamma rho 1, 1. Okay, and then gamma would typically be, I should have mentioned this up here, gamma is going to be some parameter between 0 and 1, which characterizes the strength of the amplitude damping, or the strength of the coupling to the electromagnetic field, or the strength of the coupling to whatever system it is you're losing coherence to because of an interaction. And so you can see, if rho in was equal to 1, 0, 0, 0, am I doing this backwards? I want it the other way around, right? So the, I guess my ground state is upside down. If rho in is like this, then rho out is equal to gamma 1 minus gamma times 0. Well, that's weird. Okay, that's fine. Okay, yeah, yeah. That's 0, 0, 0, 1 minus gamma. So what we see is a, what we see is, so first we see a population transfer from 1 to 0. So I apologize for the inconsistency of notation. Now all of a sudden my ground state is labeled with a 1 if we want to use this to model the atom. So sorry, there's a stand, there's a convention here and there's a clash of conventions right now. Okay, but you're saying, well, what about coherence? You promised me that we were going to lose coherence. Well, first of all, notice that this state is pure. All right, this is a pure state. And this is a mixed state. So we've lost purity as a consequence of this population transfer. Until if we repeat this process many times, gamma will reach 1 and we'll be left in a pure state again, but it'll be the, you know, the ground state, which is the, oh no. Oh yeah, that's okay, right. This isn't backwards. This is the decay of an excited state to a ground state, which is what I wanted, because, yeah, sorry. Okay, it is consistent. Okay, so then eventually the state will be mixed until it returns, until it reaches the ground state, and then it'll be pure again. Yeah, that's okay. But my zero state is my ground state. So that's what confused me. But now a little more interesting example, a more interesting case is if the initial state, rho initial, is a coherent superposition of, say, 1 over square root of 2, 0 plus 1. So this is, again, a pure state. But now it's a pure state, this will have off-diagonal elements. So now we'll have rho in is equal to a half, what is this, 1 over square root of 2 So that looks, I mean, you'd look at this and say, oh, well, that's a mixed state because it has a mixture of populations. But no, it's a pure, this is a pure state It's an evenly weighted superposition of up and down, or 0 and 1.
This is 1 over 2 as well. Yeah, that's right. 1 over 2. Thank you. Sorry, this example is from the top of my head.
So that's a pure state, but it's not an eigenstate of our basis that we're using. So it's a pure state, but not an eigenstate of the basis we're expressing the problem in. Okay, then what you get is then rho out will be equal to what it'll be. It'll be 1/2 plus gamma 1/2. And then we get this off-diagonal term. And the same thing on this side. And then this is going to be 1 minus gamma times 1/2.
So now the key point is this. When you typically want to talk about purity or coherence, you can look at the off-diagonal elements, and you see that this off-diagonal element of 1/2, which characterizes the amount of coherence you have between 0 and 1, is being attenuated by a factor. Gamma is between 0 and 1, so this is some fraction between 0 and 1, and we see an attenuation of the off-diagonal terms.
So let me just say that here. Note the attenuation of the off-diagonal
All right, so this is decoherence. All right, all of these cases. Yes?
Where did we get the Krauss operators from?
It's a toy model, a phenomenological model.
We didn't derive that from
something. Okay, now we get back to, what's your name again? I forgot.
Daniel.
We get back to Daniel's question now, which is how do we derive these things, in particular when you have this one family parameter of CP maps? Does that correspond to some one, you know, what some family of unitaries? So I'm going to tell you a bit about that problem because it's very rich and very deep, and then I'll also tell you a bit about how that ties in with why you shouldn't take these generalized postulates we're using now as primitives, which is my own opinion. It's a guess. A lot of research is about guesses because we don't know the answer, right? What's the the funniest joke? Okay. Oh my God, I'm going to date myself. The funniest joke I've seen from a fax machine spam, which you guys probably don't even know what that is. I was actually in the biology department in grad school visiting a friend. And people would send spam to your fax machine, which is weird. And the spam was, the printout came out of the fax machine and it said, "If we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research." I love that. I guess you guys don't appreciate that as much as I do. But the point is, you know, we're guessing because we don't have the complete picture, so we have to go on hunches, right? So I think that this is like a hunch, that why I think the. But let me get to it. I'm giving too much of a back.
With those two operators, if you have like A1 as being the first operator and you see between that, and you're only going to allow two operators, then A0 is the expression.
Well, the constraint, okay, the only constraint is sum over A dagger A is equal to identity, where I can never remember which side the dagger's on, but I think that's right. Is that enough to fully constrain A1? I don't know. This is a nonlinear constraint, so it's difficult to evaluate.
Are you saying that given A0, you said that? No, given it, so A1 is like, it looks like an
anomaly. Oh, it is a lot like that, actually.
So you take that,
yeah.
And you get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So let me return to what I was saying. So look. Here's the thing. This has been a long-standing problem.
how do you describe atomic decay is generally an exponential process. We know that experimentally. It turns out that if you look on very, very short timescales for atomic decay, like order 10 to the minus 12 or 10 to the minus 15 seconds, then it's not actually exponential, it's parabolic. But we know that from theory, not from experiment. And the initial parabolic part of the decay is actually critical to why you have a quantum Zeno effect and so on. But other than that initial short time period, which is parabolic, we see an effective exponential decay. Radioactivity is described by exponentials, lifetimes of atoms. It's very common for very simple, very, very simple physical systems, like the atom, to have this exponential decay process for spontaneous emission, also for nuclei. And the question is, we know that's true experimentally. How do we show that that's a consequence of our postulates? And it turns out that's a very hard thing to do. And the only way it's been done is to do it approximately. And Daniel, this answer is for you. I hope you're paying attention. Okay, good. So the general procedure for doing this is known as the Born-Markov approximation. And it's actually quite messy, but you start by assuming you have a system in a Hilbert space HA and an Ancilla space, which we could call HB, the Hilbert space HB. And then you want to assume that the Hilbert space of HB is very large, so that when the information, when the unitary that couples your system and puts some of its information on the Ancilla, you don't want that information to come back again, because then it won't be exponential. You'll get a revival. You want the information to go into the Ancilla system and then stay there, okay? And so a simple model of that is you just have your system being hit by scatterers, and each scatterer goes off to infinity, so it can never couple to your system again and bring the information back. But so in terms of a mathematical derivation of what's called Markovian dynamics of the system, which means that there's no memory, and in particular, the exponential decay process is Markovian. So if I want to describe the transformation lambda associated with some time tau, it shouldn't matter what happened previous to the time I'm describing. So that's the Markovian assumption. All that matters is the length of the time interval over which I want to describe the system. So you want the dynamics to be Markovian, and to get that Markovian approximation, you have to assume that the Hilbert space of the Ancilla is very large, and then you have to do a bunch of mathematical tricks, which people have found to be somewhat dubious. And then you have to coarse grain time. And then you get this effective description of an exponential decay process, which is a one parameter family semigroup associated with atomic decay. And so you don't get it from some simple, just you take some simple family of unitaries and just, you know, take the partial trace and you're done. You actually have to do a whole bunch of approximations, which essentially guarantee that when the systems couple, but once the information goes into the environment, there's no back action back on the system. And that's, of course, not true. There's always back action, but you want to work in a limit where that's negligible. And that's what allows you to derive this empirically known formula for atomic decay. All right, so that's in a nutshell. I mean, it's a very rich subject. I'm teaching open quantum systems in the fall at University of Waterloo, and there we spend a week on that. So that says that. Now, so that's how we get a description of Markovian processes. Now, I want to segue from there into telling you a bit about why these generalized postulates you should see more as recipes than as fundamental. So the first reason, and I don't think I might not write any of this down. So the first reason is that, look, we just had a postulate in terms of discrete time. I said, if you want to describe the transformation of your system from 0 to tau, from time t1 to time t2, you can use a completely positive map. But wait a minute. If time is continuous, which it may well be, seems to be so far, then you want a continuous time description. Certainly our unitary operators have continuous time, but our CP maps only have continuous time, say, in this one parameter family semigroup setting. And that's obtained via an approximation. But our postulate was stated in terms of discrete time. So there's clearly some disconnect there. We can't just start with the CP map picture which is a discrete time picture, without thinking about it a bit more carefully about how to show that continuous time unitary dynamics is a special case of that, which maybe you can do. I think that's an open problem. My second reason for being skeptical about these generalized postulates being fundamental is that the most general, and this is probably the most important one, the most general transformation that can occur from time t1 to t2 for my system on Hilbert space A is not a completely positive map. It's not even a linear map. The description of systems over some finite time is a mathematical problem that is unsolved currently. Okay, so let me just write that down. So the main reason, so let's just make a remark. So who knows what I'm getting at? What assumption did we make? And I don't remember if I made this explicitly, actually. Well, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Who's going to guess? Somewhere in there, I snuck in an assumption that looked pretty innocent, and it gave us completely positive maps. But in fact, we're not justified in making that assumption. Any takers? Okay, I'm going to write all the way over here. We assume the following initial state. Well, the 0,0 part wasn't the part, it was the factorable part that was the problem. Rho A tensor sigma B. Okay, so here rho A is a density operator. Rho A and sigma B are density operators. HA and HB respectively. And then we said, okay, well then rho A out is equal to the trace over B of some UAB rho A tensor sigma B UAB dagger. And then we showed that this was equal to lambda rho A. I'm going to call this in, where lambda is a CP map. Okay, we can even forget about trace preserving if we want to describe measurements. So if for the actual calculation, we assume sigma B was 0,0, but that was just for simplicity. We can make this any mixture we want, and we still get lambda as a CP map. But why am I allowed to assume that the system is uncoupled to the ancilla initially? There's no tiny little bit of correlation that I missed experimentally. Okay, maybe the systems were coupled a bit. And it turns out that this has actually been observed in the lab. So this was an experiment done in the Corey group in 2003 that I was involved in. And we were characterizing the transformation for this NMR quantum processor on 3 qubits. And we found that after doing the tomography, that our description of the process wasn't completely positive. And moreover, it wasn't even linear. All right, so let's see how that arises. But so a natural first guess would be, look, you do an experiment, you have finite statistics. So it could just be that, you know, your best guess for the transformation wasn't a CP map, but it was statistically close to some CP map. But you know, we did some analysis and managed to prove that that wasn't the case. And in fact, the problem was deeper. The problem was that actually the system of interest, which was our 3 spin-half particles, so some 8-dimensional Hilbert space, you know, this is some molecule in a liquid, and it's coupled to all kinds of degrees of freedom, rotational degrees of freedom, other molecules nearby, and so on. And that causes decoherence, which leads to a completely positive map. But if we start describing the system at some time, the degrees of freedom that cause decoherence could have been already correlated with the state of the system, which wasn't prepared perfectly. And so the point is, this whole completely positive picture breaks down if this assumption breaks down. So if we have instead rho in is of the form sum over I pi rho ai tensor sigma bi, then we have different initial states of the system that are correlated, not even entangled, just classical correlation is enough for this to break down. Classically correlated with different states of the environment. But now, if these are states of the environment which cause the effective decoherence we talked about, you know, you're interacting with that system and losing coherence to it, what you can have is that the kind of decoherence you see depends on the state of the environment, right? Different environment states cause different modes of decoherence. But the different environment states are correlated with different initial states of the system, which means that the effective decoherence dynamics are nonlinear. I.e., the decoherence induced by environment state sigma IB depends on, this is the definition of nonlinearity, depends on which state rho I depends on the different states rho I in the decomposition. So I have different possible input states. These are correlated with different environment states. The interaction between the system and the environment leads to decoherence, which depends on the properties of the environment state. This then means that the dynamics seen by rho A depends on which input state it had. Quantum mechanics is normally considered to be linear. Unitary evolution is linear in that the evolution doesn't depend on the initial state. It acts on the initial state, but the transformation doesn't share the same index with the initial state, right? That's a nonlinear function. And here we need nonlinearity to describe this process. So not only is the map not completely positive, it's not even a linear process. So this, for me, is a major reason why I think that this axiomatization of quantum mechanics in terms of the generalized postulates is misleading. because it doesn't capture the full richness of what can happen. To get the full richness of what can happen, we have to dilate to the bigger Hilbert space and look at everything explicitly, and then we can obtain a valid description of the set of possibilities. And it'll be mathematically messy, not as nice and simple as a completely positive map, but correct. Yeah?
Can you just, so you can write down your new state as like a unitary is acting on some, you know, I'd say it's a unitary is acting on some condition state, which is kind of like you're going back in time to some place where these systems are decoupled. Right? So I can write that thing, I can write your row in as like, say, row north.
We can go back in time, sure. Well, eventually you get to the Big Bang, though, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then they're definitely coupled.
Not even thinking about time, just like you can always write some unitary reactor in the Hilbert space, starting at a separable system. So then you can get this kind of transformation out as it was a CPTP, but it's not a CPTP acting on row A in. It's a CPTP acting on like this previous state. Can you
sure.
get anything out of that? Like, could you extend your definition in that way?
Well, I think that's kind of missing the point, because what's the goal of the generalized postulates, right? Why are we even bothering to talk about them? And when we have the ideal axioms in terms of unitaries and pure states, right? It's because you don't want to be dilating in time and dilating in space. You want to say, oh, I want a compact description of just the system I care about over just the timescale I care about. And the premise has been that we can do that. And I'm claiming that we can't do that, that we always have to do some dilation, whether it's looking at things beyond the timescale I want to describe them, or looking at a bigger Hilbert space, which is then very natural. And so this is just kind of an advanced comment. If there are some subtleties here that you're troubled by, don't worry about it. This is really just this is a nuance that's related to an open research problem, because some people have tried to characterize, how do we characterize this rich nonlinear structure for dynamics with some kind of, you know, in some kind of formal way? And it's actually a very hard problem. A few people have tackled it and not been successful. Yeah, just ask me over lunch and I can give you some names of people that worked on it. Okay, good. That's probably a natural stopping point. So just to give you a heads up, so I'll send you some lecture notes which will include all of this, and tomorrow's lecture and Wednesday's lecture also are included. And certainly if you find any typos in the notes, let me know. I'd love to get them as tight as possible, so please point out any mistakes to me.